Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, March 13, 2024. The U.S. House passes a bill requiring the Chinese company that owns the short video app TikTok to sell it or not be able to distribute it in the United States. Supporters point to the Chinese Communist Party's ability to obtain and exploit TikTok user data. House Republicans start their policy retreat at the Greenbrier Resort in West Virginia, but perhaps half their members do not plan to be there. We'll talk about it with Axios congressional reporter Julie Grace Brufke. President Biden campaigns in Milwaukee the day after he clinches the nomination of the Democratic Party for president. Donald Trump also clinched the Republican Party nomination in Tuesday's contests. Secretary of State Antony Blinken talks about latest efforts to get humanitarian aid into Gaza and addresses calls by some members of Congress to cut military aid to Israel. And the Federal Trade Commission Chair, Lina Khan, uses Boeing as a prime example of what she calls the catastrophic results of monopolies, as she argues for more rigorous antitrust enforcement. Story at the Washington Post, the House on Wednesday approved legislation that would require TikTok's Chinese parent company ByteDance to sell it within 180 days, or risk having the app barred from app stores and web hosting services in the United States. The vote in favor was overwhelming. But that doesn't ensure the measure will become law. It must still be considered by the Senate, where Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, on Tuesday said he might block any swift consideration, something he did a year ago to a similar bill. Wednesday's vote marks the first time one of the houses of Congress has approved legislation that could effectively ban a major social media platform, one used by an estimated 170 million people in the United States monthly. That's how the Washington Post put it. Here's some of the House floor debate. Congressman Mike Gallagher, Republican of Wisconsin, chair of the Select Committee on Strategic Competition between the U.S. and the Chinese Communist Party, in support.
TikTok is a threat to our national security because it is owned by ByteDance, which does the bidding of the Chinese Communist Party. We know this because ByteDance leadership says so and because Chinese law requires it. This bill therefore forces TikTok to break up with the Chinese Communist Party. It does not apply to American companies. It only applies to companies subject to the control of foreign adversaries defined by Congress. It says nothing about election interference and cannot be turned against any American social media platform. It does not impact websites in general. The only impacted sites are those associated with foreign adversary apps, such as TikTok.com. It can never be used to penalize individuals. The text explicitly prohibits that, and it cannot be used to censor speech. It takes no position at all on the content of speech, only foreign adversary control. Foreign adversary control of what is becoming the dominant news platform for Americans under 30. This is a common sense measure to protect our national security. I urge my colleagues to support this critical bipartisan legislation.
Congressman Mike Gallagher, Republican from Wisconsin, on the House floor before the House did pass this bill. An article from AFP reads, ahead of the vote, Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin condemned the proposed ban. Although the United States has never found evidence that TikTok threatens U.S. national security, it has not stopped suppressing TikTok, he said. This kind of bullying behavior that cannot win in fair competition disrupts companies' normal business activity, damages the confidence of international investors in the investment environment, and damages the normal international economic and trade order, he said. In the end, this will inevitably come back and bite the United States itself. That was from the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson through an article at AFP. More from the U.S. House debate in Washington, Congressman Robert Garcia, Democrat of California, in opposition.
I have enormous respect for the efforts of my colleagues to focus on security and data protection, and I share many of their concerns. But I disagree with this approach and bill that could impact 170 million Americans who use TikTok. One third of all U.S. adults use the app, and millions of entrepreneurs and small business owners use the platform to support their family. And yes, just like every other social media platform, there is misinformation and privacy concerns on TikTok, and I share those. However, it's important that we don't treat TikTok differently than other platforms. If we're going to address this issue, we've got to take the same approach to all social media platforms. We can't just single out one. Now, I join many of my colleagues and the ACLU you in voicing concern over the freedom of expression. Now, I am a strong supporter of ensuring that TikTok remains an open marketplace, and there's no guarantee in this bill that there won't be an interruption of service that could lead to an end of this app. I don't think we fully appreciate the impact this is going to have, and for that, I'm a strong no. Thank you, and I yield back.
Congressman Robert Garcia, Democrat from California, on the House floor. CNBC reports that although House members who drafted the bill have previously said that it does not ban TikTok, the legislation in its current form requires ByteDance to divest TikTok within roughly 6 months in order to have the app to remain available in the United States. If the bill is enacted, app store owners such as Apple and Google, along with internet hosting companies, would be prohibited from supporting TikTok and other apps that are linked to ByteDance. The article continues, in the chance that the latest TikTok bill passes, Angelo Zeno, a vice president and senior equity analyst at CFRA Research, told CNBC it's possible that TikTok's U.S.-only business could fetch a valuation north of $60 billion when looking at peer valuations in the market. More from the House floor, Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, Democrat from Illinois, ranking member on the Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party, in favor of the bill.
This bill is not a ban, and it's not about TikTok, it's about ByteDance. Let me tell you about ByteDance. ByteDance is a 100% owner of TikTok. ByteDance is controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. In fact, the editor-in-chief of ByteDance is the secretary of the Chinese Communist Party's cell, embedded at the very highest ranks of the company. And he has been charged with making sure that TikTok and all products of ByteDance adhere to, quote, correct political direction. This particular bill ensures that ByteDance divests itself of the vast majority of the ownership of TikTok. Our intention is for TikTok to continue to operate, but not under the control of the Chinese Communist Party. Secondly, this divestment requirement is not new. It's not without precedent. When the app Grindr, a popular LGBTQ app, was acquired by a Chinese company, and the United States government determined that sensitive data of LGBTQ members of the military and U.S. government officials got into the hands of the Chinese Communist Party, they required divestment. This happened quickly. Why? Because Grindr was a very valuable social media company. The same is true with regard to TikTok, and there will be no disruption to users, just as there was with Grindr. Third point. Unfortunately, when TikTok has appeared before Congress, whether it's before the House Energy and Commerce Committee or otherwise, it has not been candid, my friends. It has not been candid. First, TikTok said its data is not accessible to China-based ByteDance employees. False. China-based employees routinely access this data, even unbeknownst to employees of TikTok USA. In addition, TikTok said its data will not be weaponized and has not been weaponized against American citizens. Again, false. Published reports have shown that TikTok data, geolocation data, has been used to surveil American journalists who reported on problems with Chinese-based employees having access to American user data.
Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, Democrat from Illinois, on the House floor before the House passed this bill. Former President Donald Trump, who, when he was in office, tried to ban TikTok, now says that he opposes the bill because it would increase the business of rival Facebook. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, cited her own shadow banning on Facebook and previous suspension on X, when it was Twitter, for her opposition to the bill.
If we wanted to be serious about stopping a foreign adversary, if we wanted to be serious about stopping China, we would stop China from buying our U.S. farmland. We would raise up our American energy independence. We would also stop the Green New Deal and not rely on China, who owns and operates 85% of the battery market worldwide. There are dangers that lie ahead in this. This is really about controlling Americans' data. And if we cared about Americans' data, then we would stop the sale of Americans' data universally, not just with China. There's some further issues. This is a Pandora's box. What's to stop Congress or the United States government in the future from forcing the sale of another social media company, claiming that it's protecting Americans' data from foreign adversaries? I think we could see in the future another Russia, 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 and possibly force the sale of X, as many members in this body claim that Elon Musk is altering the algorithms of X. By the way, it was Elon Musk's purchase of X that restored my social media account on Twitter and allowed me to have my free speech back on Twitter. There's also members of this body, the Democrats, are claiming that election meddling can happen on social media. Well, we can never forget Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook. We can never forget the election meddling that happened there. And by the way, American-owned Facebook and Instagram is where most of the garbage, like the gender lies and the woke lies, exist. Many Americans and many teenagers believe awful things, and they don't just see them on TikTok, they see them on Facebook and Instagram too. I don't think this will accomplish what the goal is to accomplish.
Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, on the House floor. The House passed this bill by a vote of 352-65, with one member voting present, Jasmine Crockett, Democrat of Texas. The 65 no's break down to 15 Republicans and 50 Democrats. And the 352-65 was more than the two-thirds majority needed under the expedited procedures the House was using to pass the bill. The bill now heads to the Senate, where the Democratic chair of the Intelligence Committee, Mark Warner of Virginia, and the Republican vice chair, Marco Rubio of Florida, putting out a joint statement in support, saying, "We are united in our concern about the national security threat posed by TikTok, a platform with enormous power to influence and divide Americans, whose parent company, ByteDance, remains legally required to do the bidding of the Chinese Communist Party. We were encouraged by today's strong bipartisan vote in the House of Representatives and look forward to working together to get this bill passed through the Senate and signed into law." And the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, with a very short statement, "The Senate will review the legislation when it comes over from the House." And President Biden has previously said he would sign the bill into law if it passes both the House and Senate and is sent to his desk. An NBC poll in January found that 22% of voters use TikTok once or more per day, and that includes 43% of voters ages 18 to 34. The House Democratic leader, Hakeem Jeffries, was asked today at a news conference if he has any concern for House Democrats who supported this bill.
I've heard from some of your members who are worried that, you know, given the lobbying campaign that preceded this TikTok vote, young voters will believe it's a ban, whether it is or not, and will punish the Democratic Party for joining it in force, given that they're the overwhelming, you know, they overwhelmingly vote for Democrats in elections. Are you concerned? Is that a valid concern that there will be a backlash from young voters to this?
I don't support a TikTok ban, and I have every confidence in the world that whatever the course of this legislation takes as it goes over to the Senate, that TikTok will remain available to those who continue to enjoy the platform at this very moment.
The House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat from New York, at his news conference. An article in Politico earlier this week read that Kellyanne Conway, the former senior Trump aide, is being paid by the conservative Club for Growth to advocate for TikTok in Congress and has had at least 10 meetings with lawmakers in recent months about the app, according to three people familiar with the meetings. Kellyanne Conway was interviewed today by Politico chief Washington correspondent Ryan Lizza.
You are advising Republicans in the House not to support this bill. And you helped, I think, convince Donald Trump to oppose this. So just quickly, tell us a little bit about your role in that and what you made of the vote.
Sure. Well, President Trump makes up his own mind. He has spoken for himself through a Truth Social post a week ago and through an interview with CNBC's Squawk Box 2 days ago on Monday, Ryan, where he very clearly said an empowered and emboldened Mark Zuckerberg, who President Trump believes interfered with the 2020 elections through $500 million in Zuckerbucks going to two nonprofits and then going out to get out the vote and do some other things. He feels that if Zuckerberg or even another social media company consolidates that power. We're creating tech barons by having Mark Zuckerberg potentially in charge of Facebook and Instagram and now TikTok, that would not be good. The other thing that President Trump has pointed out is the sheer number of users. I've seen up to 170 million quoted as the figure, U.S. users monthly. And as President Trump said on Monday, his belief that you have a lot of young people in there, a lot of females, a lot of voters who they like it. And it's not just for entertainment. Maybe it started out that way. There's a lot of connection and community on TikTok. I'm not even on TikTok. I'm not even one of the 170 million users. I just believe in the First Amendment and the 14th Amendment. And I also think constitutionally, you saw the failed experiment in Montana when that state tried to be the first state to ban TikTok. They were sued by Montanans. And it's potentially a bill of attainder problem, too, under the Fifth Amendment. Can you tell I paid a lot for my law degree 30 years ago and like to use it once in a while? But also, I just want to make very clear. TikTok is could be a national security threat, there's no question. And I personally want to hold China to account for any number of things. I think we should be holding China to account. But this is where we're starting. We don't have them confirming the origins of the COVID virus that killed over a million people in this country and many millions more worldwide. We're not telling them to get their fentanyl the hell out of our country and our kids' veins, the number one killer of 18 to 45-year-olds as we sit here in this country. We're not worried about the persecution of the religious minority, the Uyghurs. We're not worried about forced technology transfers.
Kellyanne Conway, former White House counselor in the Donald Trump administration, interviewed today at a Politico healthcare summit in Washington. The House is out of session for legislative business the rest of the week, so House Republicans can attend a policy conference or retreat today and Thursday at the Greenbrier Resort in Sulphur Springs, West Virginia. Congressman Ken Buck, Republican of Colorado, talked about the low expected attendance at the House Republican retreat in an interview on Tuesday on CNN and about his decision to resign from Congress effective March 22nd.
My colleague Melanie Zanona is reporting that there is such tension among House Republicans that many of them aren't even going to a retreat that's going to happen at the end of this week. Is that tension part of why you're leaving so abruptly?
I think this place is dysfunctional. For example, I am the number third ranking member of the Judiciary Committee. I haven't even asked my questions yet. 40, 50 people have gone before me.
But that could be personal.
It could be personal, but a lot of this is personal, and that's the problem. Instead of having decorum, instead of operating in a professional manner, this place has just evolved into this bickering and nonsense and not really doing the job for the American people.
How much of the fact that you are leaving March 22nd, next Friday, how much does that have to do with the fact that Trump is the presumptive nominee and you're not exactly a fan?
Well, I don't think whether he was the nominee or not, I think our system is broken in how we choose candidates, and I want to get involved in that process.
Is it really that miserable right now to be? I mean, from the outside in, it doesn't look that fun. From the inside in, is it that bad that you're saying I'm done?
It is the worst year of the 9 years and 3 months that I've been in Congress. And having talked to former members, it's the worst year in 40, 50 years to be in Congress. But I'm leaving because I think there's a job to do out there that I want to go do.
Congressman Ken Buck, Republican from Colorado, interviewed on CNN Tuesday night. An article at Axios.com begins, the House GOP is in turmoil ahead of its policy retreat in West Virginia on Wednesday, with attendance expected to be sparse and a keynote speaker dropping out. Joining us now on the phone from that retreat at the Greenbrier Resort in West Sulphur Springs, West Virginia, is Julie Grace Brufke, congressional reporter for Axios. Thanks for being with us. So
thank you for having me.
Why are so many Republicans in the House skipping this retreat?
To a number of members, some of them want to go back to their districts and feel like it's a more productive use of their time to kind of go talk to constituents headed as we kind of approach election season. This year it's in West Virginia instead of Florida, so members bringing their families kind of felt like that was a better option last year. And then some of them felt like they kind of got the logistical information too late and had already made commitments back in their districts. So that's kind of the lay of the land right now. So there's going to be less than 100 of them is what I was told by a couple sources here. But leadership is trying to make the best of it.
What about that turmoil that you mentioned?
Well, I mean, I talked to a few members that said some of the regular conference meetings get kind of heated there, and they feel like moving it to a resort and having days of essentially conference meetings that they do weekly isn't going to really be a productive use of their time or really kind of help bring them together. And if anything, I talked to a couple that said they think members out at a resort drinking might make things worse than the current dynamic. So that was some of the critics of the retreat's takes. But yes, so that's kind of where things stand right now.
What do we know about the agenda at the House Republican retreat, that keynote speaker who canceled?
So one of their star speakers, Larry Kudlow, he's officially out. So he dropped at the 11th hour there. So some members are kind of disappointed about that since he was one of their keynote speakers there. But they still have some pro-life speakers, a former defense secretary, and a couple of former Ways and Means chairman, Kevin Brady, and former Energy and Commerce chairman, Greg Walden, that are still supposed to come speak to them about policy over the next couple days.
When it comes to policy, what will they be talking about? What do they think is going to be accomplished at the retreat and then legislatively the next year?
So a bunch of the chairmen will give talks and kind of try and unify on what their agenda will be for next year and kind of try and find some common ground on some things they'd like to accomplish. So that's kind of their goal right now, to kind of get people out of their normal element at the Capitol and kind of bring people together to be able to kind of work out policy goals and what they'd like to do for the rest of this Congress and moving into next Congress and kind of what they can pitch to voters as they head into November.
When you speak to the House Republican members about how Speaker Mike Johnson is doing in the job almost 5 months in, what do they say?
Well, I've spoken to some members. They feel like he's still kind of getting his sea legs and there's been some frustrations, but some of them are they've been happy that he's kind of had a more bottom-up approach than Kevin McCarthy and is listening to their concerns. I've talked to some members that kind of feel like they'd like to see him be a little more decisive in his actions and a little more kind of lean in and articulate what he'd like to see from a decision-making standpoint. But, I mean, he's still fresh, and I think there are some understandings of that, some sense of understanding for that with members.
Julie Grace Brufke, congressional reporter for Axios. Her stories are at axios.com and on X at Julie Grace B. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
And a story from CNN reads, publicly, Republicans have cited a litany of reasons for not attending the retreat, from having to tend to reelection races to scheduling conflicts. Nancy Mace of South Carolina, for example, is scheduled to appear on Real Time with Bill Maher later this week. Meanwhile, when asked if he was attending, GOP Rep. Kelly Armstrong of North Dakota told CNN, "No way, I have to run for governor." And Tim Burchett of Tennessee quipped, "I don't retreat, I move forward. I got a farm to run." The article also says, but privately, some Republicans have complained about the venue choice. Sources said Speaker Mike Johnson selected the Greenbrier Resort because it was family friendly, in a break from past retreats, which have taken place in sunny Florida, the preferred location of former Speaker Kevin McCarthy. That was from CNN. President Joe Biden is campaigning today in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, a battleground state, one day after clinching the Democratic Party nomination in Tuesday's primaries. Reuters writes, the White House said President Biden would announce $3.3 billion in projects in 40 states to reconnect communities divided by highways decades ago, using funding from both the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law and the Inflation Reduction Act. Tuesday night, this video titled "Let's Go" was posted on X by @JoeBiden.
This is a time of choosing. So let us choose the truth. Let us choose America. Today is a day to call to action with your voice, with your power, with your vote. Come November, we will vote in record numbers. And we can do it. It's within your power to do it. Are you ready? Are you ready to defend democracy? Are you ready to protect our freedom? Are you ready to win this election?
That video posted by President Joe Biden on his non-official X account Tuesday night. Former President Donald Trump also secured the necessary presidential primary delegates from Tuesday's contest to guarantee he'll be the Republican presidential nominee this year. And he posted a video on his social network, Truth Social.
The Republican National Committee has just declared us the official nominee. And so we're the official nominee of the Republican Party, which is a big deal. But most importantly, we now have to go into victory because our country's in serious trouble. We have millions and millions of people flowing in. We have no respect on the world stage. What we say doesn't mean a thing anymore. And to have that happen is unthinkable. We have an economy that outside of certain little areas is doing very poorly. And we have something very, very important. We have a United States military that has to be taken care of. Again, this was a great day of victory. Last week was something very special, Super Tuesday. But now we have to get back to work because we have the worst president in the history of our country. His name is Joe Biden, sometimes referred to as Crooked Joe Biden, and he must be defeated.
Former President Donald Trump, a Republican presidential candidate, as he said, the presumptive nominee this year, part of a video he posted Tuesday night. Associated Press reporting that the judge overseeing the Georgia 2020 election interference case on Wednesday dismissed some of the charges against former President Donald Trump and others, but the rest of the sweeping racketeering indictment remains intact. Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee quashed six counts in the indictment, including three against Trump, but the judge left in place other counts, including 10 facing Trump, and said prosecutors could seek a new indictment to try to reinstate the ones he dismissed. That was reporting from AP. And this from CBS News. Hunter Biden, President Biden's son, will not testify publicly before the House Oversight and Accountability Committee at a hearing scheduled for next week. His lawyer informed the panel's Republican chairman in a letter Wednesday. Abby Lowell, the lawyer, wrote, "Your blatant planned for media event is not a proper proceeding, but an obvious attempt to throw a Hail Mary pass after the game has ended." He called the hearing a carnival sideshow and said Hunter Biden would consider an invitation to a hearing with relatives of former President Trump who have engaged in their own work overseas after Trump left office. James Comer, the committee chair, said in a statement that the hearing will proceed and Republicans expect Hunter Biden to participate. He wrote, "The committee has called Hunter Biden's bluff. Hunter Biden for months stated he wanted a public hearing, but now that one has been offered alongside his business associates that he worked with for years, he is refusing to come." The chairman said that during the earlier phase of Republicans' investigation, Hunter Biden confirmed key evidence but contradicted testimony from former business partners who appeared before House investigators. That was from CBS News. And Washington Today continues in a moment.
Hi, I'm Tammy, and joining me today is Paul, as we celebrate 45 years of C-SPAN's unblinking eye on the democratic process.
That's right, Tammy. Since our founding in 1979, C-SPAN has been documenting history with a unique approach, unfiltered, without commentary, and entirely independent from government funding. C-SPAN is funded by fees from our cable and satellite distribution partners, and now with fewer people subscribing to cable and satellite, we're asking you to help support our next 45 years.
It's amazing to see how C-SPAN has adapted and grown. With the rise of digital platforms and social media, C-SPAN has expanded its reach. So no matter where you are, you have 24/7, 365 access to the democratic process.
And as we navigate this ever-changing media environment, C-SPAN's dedication to putting you in the rooms where politics is debated and policy is determined will not waver.
We ask you to support C-SPAN's vital mission. As we celebrate 45 years of service, your contribution helps us to continue to adapt and grow in this digital age. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your contribution today.
Here's to 45 more years of bringing democracy directly to you wherever you get your news. Thank you for your support. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make a difference.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app and wherever you find your podcasts. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, writes Reuters, said on Wednesday he held a video conference with officials from Cyprus, Britain, the UAE, Qatar, and European Union and United Nations to discuss getting a new maritime corridor for getting humanitarian aid into Gaza up and running. Blinken said the corridor, once established, would enable distribution of up to 2 million meals in Gaza, where aid agencies say the five-month-long war between Israel and Hamas has driven much of the population to the brink of famine. That's the reporting from Reuters. The Pentagon has said it could take up to 2 months to build the temporary pier off the Gaza coast that President Biden has announced. Secretary Blinken held a news conference today at the State Department in Washington.
President Biden, in his interview, also said he wouldn't suspend any military aid to Israel in a way that would impact, for example, the Iron Dome. Does that mean the United States would consider putting conditions on offensive weapons to Israel? Secondly, you met with EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell today. He said at UN, Israel is using starvation as a weapon of war. Do you agree with that? And if you don't, who do you think is responsible for the man-made famine in Gaza? And lastly, there has been an Israeli airstrike today on an UNRWA aid distribution center in Rafah. The agency said at least one staff has been killed. It also said that they've shared the coordinates of this facility with the Israeli army in the hope that it would be protected. What can you tell us about this incident? Thank you.
So let me take those questions. Actually, let me start with the last one. So I saw the reports of the strike today on the UNRWA facility. And first and foremost, our condolences go out to the families and loved ones of those who apparently lost their lives in this strike. I don't know the details of what happened. I do know, based on what we've heard from the Israeli government, that the IDF is investigating, the Israeli Defense Forces are investigating this incident. And of course, we will look closely to see what that investigation produces. Without getting into the specifics of this incident, because again, I don't know the facts, I think it does, as a general matter, underscore something I talked about a few minutes ago, and that's the imperative of having much better and much more consistent deconfliction. Humanitarian workers, the agencies, they need to be able to do their jobs in with as much security and as much confidence as is possible. And look, you're in a war zone. You have a terrorist group that is firing from hospitals, from schools, from apartment buildings. But the Israeli military, the Israeli government have a responsibility and an obligation to do everything possible to ensure that the humanitarians can do their jobs. And among other things, that means making sure that if there's a humanitarian facility that's clearly identified, it's not struck. It means making sure that if there's a supply mission, a convoy, trucks going to a particular place at a particular time, that the Israeli military does everything possible to ensure its secure passage. So this is an ongoing process. It's made, again, incredibly difficult by the environment in which it's being conducted, but it is a responsibility and an imperative for the Israelis. What we've seen in terms of food, as well as other supplies, going to your the second part of your question, is, of course, the Israelis have been not only allowing food in, they have been working to make sure that it gets in and gets to people who need it. We've seen throughout this this process, first, the opening of Rafah back in October. After my first visit to Israel, many hours of discussion, Rafah opened, assistance began to get in. We went back some weeks later. We got agreement to open Kerem Shalom. During the first pause, the hostage pause, 1 week, the amount of assistance that was then going in doubled during that period of time. Since then, we've pressed them on doing things like getting flour in from Ashdod. I mentioned that a short while ago. The flour that is now getting in to Gaza is enough to produce bread to last for 6 months in Gaza. We have a new opening that was just put in place that will facilitate more assistance going in. And, of course, I talked about the maritime corridor that we're building. We've been doing airdrops. The bottom line is food is getting in, but it's insufficient. That's why we're talking about doing everything possible to maximize not only what gets in, but what gets to people. But I think that answers the second part of the question. And finally, look, let me just say this about our commitment. Our commitment is to make sure that Israel has the means to defend itself, to provide for its own security, and that's an enduring commitment.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken, part of his news conference today at the State Department in Washington. Another Reuters story, a second shipment of aid will be sent from Cyprus to Gaza in coming days, its foreign minister said on Wednesday. Citing growing acceptance, the island could play a pivotal role in delivering supplies by sea to the shattered Palestinian enclave. Story from TheHill.com, a group of Senate Democrats led by Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, Jeff Merkley, Democrat of Oregon, and Chris Van Hollen, Democrat from Maryland, are demanding President Biden comply with the Foreign Assistance Act and cut off military aid to Israel. Senators argued in a Monday letter to Biden that Section 620I of the Foreign Assistance Act requires Biden administration to halt the sale and transfer of weapons to Israel if Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government continues to block humanitarian assistance to Gaza. That from The Hill. Today, Congressman James McGovern, Democrat of Massachusetts, supported this in a statement on the floor.
President Biden, in my opinion, has failed to comply with U.S. law by continuing to send U.S. military aid to Israel. Section 620I of the Foreign Assistance Act is very clear. It states, and I quote, "No assistance shall be furnished under this act or the Arms Export Control Act to any country when it is made known to the President that the government of such country prohibits or otherwise restricts directly or indirectly the transport and delivery of United States humanitarian assistance." That is what is happening in Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has made a deliberate choice to use food, water, and medicine as weapons against the people of Gaza. He has restricted and stopped the delivery of aid, including U.S. aid, from reaching suffering, starving civilians in Gaza. This is a violation of U.S. law. President Biden, use your leverage. No more U.S. military aid to Israel in contradiction of our own laws. Trucks of food and medicine need to start rolling into Gaza now. Please, please, Mr. President, use your leverage now.
Congressman James McGovern, Democrat from Massachusetts, on the House floor. From Associated Press, President Vladimir Putin said Wednesday that Russia is ready to use nuclear weapons if its sovereignty or independence is threatened, issuing another blunt warning to the West just days before an election in which he's all but certain to secure another six-year term. Asked in an interview with Russian state television released early Wednesday if he has ever considered using battlefield nuclear weapons in Ukraine, Putin responded that there has been no need for that. He also noted that he doesn't think that the world is heading for a nuclear war, describing U.S. President Joe Biden as a veteran politician who fully understands the possible dangers of escalation. That was from Associated Press. Reporters asked the White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre about this during a flight on Air Force One.
Was the president briefed on the Putin interview and his comments about nuclear weapons and being ready to, respond?
So the president certainly is aware. I can say that, look, we understand that Mr. Putin was restating Russia's nuclear doctrine. This was a question that he was asked, right? Nevertheless, Russia's nuclear rhetoric has been reckless and irresponsible throughout this conflict. It is Russia that brutally invaded Ukraine without provocation or justification, and will continue to support Ukraine as they defend their people and their sovereign territory from Russian aggression.
The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, part of her news conference on Air Force One, flying with the president. The U.S. House Democratic discharge petition to force a House vote on the $95 billion foreign aid bill for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan that passed the Senate was open for signature today. Last count reported, 177, 218, a majority of the House need to sign to force that vote. Another AP article about Haiti, a proposal to install new leadership in Haiti, appeared to be crumbling Wednesday as some political parties rejected the plan to create a presidential council that would manage the transition. The panel would be responsible for selecting an interim prime minister and a council of ministers that would attempt to chart a new path for the Caribbean country that's been overrun by gangs. The violence has closed schools and businesses and disrupted daily life across Haiti. That from Associated Press. Wall Street today, the Dow up 37, NASDAQ down 87, S&P down 9. From ABC News, Boeing overwrote surveillance footage from the repair facility where a door plug was reinstalled ahead of the blowout on an Alaska Airlines flight earlier this year, according to a letter Wednesday from National Transportation Safety Board Chair Jennifer Homendy to the Senate Commerce Committee. The NTSB still does not know which Boeing employees worked on the failed door plug of Alaska Airlines 1282, which had its door plug blow out during a flight in January, Homendy also said in the letter. That was from ABC News. The Federal Trade Commission chair, Lina Khan, today used the Boeing company as an example of what she said is the danger of monopoly. It leads to less innovation and quality and geopolitical vulnerability, she says. She spoke at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C.
In the 1990s, a White House advisor noted that there was one very high-tech firm that was, quote, a de facto national champion, so important that you can be an out-and-out advocate for it in government. And we did support it, providing it with government contracts and allowing it to consolidate the industry. I'm referring, of course, to Boeing, which is the single best example of why a national champion strategy can be catastrophic. In 1997, Boeing became the only commercial aerospace maker in the United States. It came to enjoy this status after buying up McDonnell Douglas, the only other domestic producer of commercial airplanes, a merger that had been reviewed by the FTC. Boeing is the clearest example of a purposeful decision to bet on national champions on behalf of American interests. To override European objections to this merger, the White House reportedly threatened the WTO with threatened WTO sanctions if the EU had challenged it. Policymakers wanted a national champion, and so they got it. As with most highly concentrated industries, three things happened after Boeing eliminated its domestic competition. As United Airlines CEO Scott Kirby recently noted, the merger allowed Boeing to slow down innovation and to reduce product quality. Boeing's R&D budget has been constantly lower than that of its only rival, Airbus. Worse quality is one of the harms that most economists expect from monopolization, because firms that face little competition have limited incentive to improve their products. Second, Boeing executives started to view their knowledgeable workforce as a cost rather than an asset, with tragic outcomes. As one consultant put it in 2000, Boeing has always been less a business than an association of engineers devoted to building amazing flying machines. This corporation's engineers designed the B-52 in a single weekend. But the new post-merger Boeing decimated its workforce, offshored production, and demanded wage concessions. The third consequence was that Boeing effectively became too big to fail and a point of leverage for countries seeking to influence U.S. policymaking. In 2020, during COVID, Congress carved out a $25 billion line item just for this one aerospace producer. Relying on a national champion creates supply weaknesses and taxpayer liabilities, but it also creates geopolitical vulnerabilities that can be exploited both by global partners and rivals. As it was buying McDonnell Douglas, Boeing held a board meeting in Beijing and lobbied Congress to end the annual review of China's trading rights so that it could sell more planes. The Chinese government, in turn, would order Boeing planes contingent upon certain U.S. policies, like whether the U.S. held off on sending warships into the Strait of Taiwan or whether the U.S. lifted bans on the export of certain technologies. National champions are still corporations first. They have earnings calls, shareholders, and quarterly profit targets. When policymakers in Washington decide to back a single monopoly, their objectives are but one concern among many for that corporation's senior executives.
The Federal Trade Commission Chair, Lina Khan, today at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, an event looking at antitrust law and the future of innovation. And finally, on Washington Today, C-SPAN has announced the winners of the 2024 Student Cam documentary competition. The theme this year was looking forward while considering the past. This is the 20th C-SPAN Student Cam. Students could explore either what is the most important change you would like to see in the next 20 years or what has been the most important change over the past 20 years. 3,200 students around the U.S. participated. Some of the most popular topics included artificial intelligence, social media, healthcare, climate, school safety, and homelessness. C-SPAN awarded $150,000 in cash prizes to students and educators. Here are the winners.
In the middle school division, the first prize goes to Maytal Zayat from Isaac Graham Newton Middle School in Mountain View, California. The documentary, Beyond Just Sci-Fi, AI Reshaping America's Tomorrow, delves into the evolving world of artificial intelligence. The high school Eastern Division's first prize is awarded to Dermot Foley from Montgomery Blair High School in Silver Spring, Maryland, for his film The Promise of Langley Park, The Purple Line, Climate Change, and Reimagining the Future of America's Suburbs. Brianna Johnson and Leah Sorelli from Troy Athens High School in Troy, Michigan, claimed the first prize in their high school Central Division with their production Unseen Heroes, The Caregivers of America. In the high school Western Division, Brendan Jang, Emily Tang, and Max Ryder from Palo Alto Senior High School in California earned first prize for Threads of Change, which takes a critical look at the fast fashion industry. And our top award of $5,000 for grand prize goes to Nate Coleman and Jonah Rothline, 10th graders at Weston High School in Connecticut. Their compelling documentary, Innocence Held Hostage, Navigating Past and Future Conflicts with Iran.
And congratulations to all the 2024 Student Cam Documentary Competition winners and the educators and parents who supported them and all the contestants. You can watch the winning videos at studentcam.org. For 20 years, C-SPAN Student Cam has been a catalyst for inspiring young minds to think critically about issues that are important to them and has empowered them with the tools they need to become informed, civically engaged citizens. Over 63,000 students and 20,000 teachers have participated in the two decades, and C-SPAN has awarded more than $1.5 million in prizes. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's free evening newsletter, Word for Word, and get the stories making headlines in Washington sent to your inbox every day. Sign up at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night.